Hello, and welcome to the Cambie Report. My name is Patrick Meehan, and this time I am not joined by Ian Bushfield or Matthew Naylor, because this is a very special episode of the Cambie Report, where we're doing a run-through of what occurred at Council yesterday. We're going to be hopefully bringing this to you on a fairly regular basis, as one or more of us are able to attend Council throughout the coming term, and our goal is to be able to give you a rundown of some of the more interesting or controversial motions that occur. So yesterday, I attended Council bright and early in the morning on Wednesday, December 12th, and went to go primarily. I wanted to see the land value capture motion. I thought there might be some controversy or some arguments there. It ended up being a lot calmer than I thought it would be. As well, there was a modular housing motion that I thought might be interesting, and what turned into the kerfuffle of the day that made it into all the newspapers was Rebecca Bligh's motion calling for the city to basically write a letter to the premier suggesting that they overturn the school tax, which is the tax that is to be imposed on all housing over the value of $3 million, and the tax is to the tune of 0.2% for the first $1 million after three, and then 0.4 for every house after $4 million. We're going to get into that a lot more. But first, I had a chance to sit down with Councillor Christine Boyle of One City to talk about her motion on the land value capture tax. Now, the land value capture tax is one that we've gone into great detail on, and I'm not going to break it down any further. In fact, I'm just going to hand it over to the interview now so that you can get a sense of what was said. And I'm joined here with Councillor Christine Boyle. Thank you for sitting down and talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
Well, first of all, I guess congratulations are in order. You passed your landmark motion.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very excited about the potential for it.
Yeah, so the number one campaign plank that your party had, really, was this land value capture tax. And you've now passed the motion, and it's going to staff and report back in July.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd call it our number one platform. It certainly was a bold and creative idea that we added to the election in terms of ways to address this housing crisis. And it fits with the bigger narrative that the One City was trying to tell in this election, which is about how we make sure that every neighborhood is for everyone. And so the land value capture is one particular tool. In addition, I think, to prioritizing building more affordable, supportive, and rental housing, particularly in our low density and wealthy neighborhoods, and strengthening tenant protections to make sure that vulnerable tenants aren't getting displaced. Mm-hmm. So I think they all fit together, and no one of these pieces is a solution on its own, but land value capture is certainly a key, you know, nerdy, important piece of how we get to that future city that we think is really possible and important.
Absolutely. So land value capture, like you said, is a nerdy topic. Do you want to sort of articulate in as few words as possible what it is?
Absolutely. So the idea is that we can measure, we're fortunate, we have a very reputable agency, BC Assessment, who give us assessments of how much land is worth separate from properties across the province. And so we can measure how much the assessed value of land goes up over time based on any number of public decisions, public infrastructure projects, which could be adding things like transit or amenities in communities. But it's also sometimes what doesn't get added, where there isn't density added, land values go up. So we can measure that lift, that increase, and a land value capture proposes that we then tax a portion of that publicly created lift to go back into public priorities. And for Vancouver right now, I think a key one is affordable housing.
Right. So why do you think there's so little understanding of this? I mean, I've seen on Twitter and other places, people who work in the housing sphere, people who are urban planners, expressing a complete lack of, I think, understanding of the issue. Why do you think that would be?
Well, I mean, we're not all as nerdy on these issues. And it does get a bit complicated. I think lots of people in Vancouver don't have a understanding of our current property tax system and the mill rate. This is something new. And there are, I think, legitimate questions that get asked about when it should be collected, you know, whether it's annually or whether it's on sale or redevelopment. And for the record, I have been saying all along, I think it makes sense to collect it at sale or redevelopment when it gets realized for people. That makes sense to me. So there are some legitimate questions, and then there's some fear-mongering, I think, by a pretty solid sort of anti-tax base, and that is to be expected because it is about making public publicly created wealth, and that isn't what we've been doing. We've been seeing a lot of publicly created wealth being privatized and collected by folks who were, you know, whatever combination of smart enough or lucky enough to buy land that's dramatically increased in value. So it's a shift in how we do that. And it won't make everyone happy, but I do think that it's a really good, important solution to be considering.
Right. And so the intent of the motion is to essentially increase the amount of taxation collected. Is that not correct?
Yeah. I mean, it could be a shift. It's about how we bring it in. So I know some of the motion this morning got supported by a couple NPA councillors who saw it as a possible way that the kind of flat mill rate property tax wouldn't need to keep rising because we would have this other avenue mm-hmm. that allows us to get at the point. A key point, I think, is that the land value capture lets us get at wealth in a pretty targeted way right where it is. Vancouver has some of the lowest property tax rates of anywhere in Canada, and it's why people speculate on real estate here, because there's a lot of money to be made without a lot of carrying cost in terms of the tax rate.
Right. So do you think this might help curb some of the speculative action that happens on the market?
Yeah. The key benefits of the land value capture are sort of two benefits that are in tension with each other. And one is that it curbs speculation because there's less money to be made on speculating because we're capturing a significant portion of it back. The other benefit is that it brings in public revenue for public priorities. And I say they're in tension with each other just because the more that it dampens speculation, the less revenue that it brings in. But both of those are good outcomes yeah. in terms of affordability. So I'm kind of agnostic to which one has more of an impact because they both get us in the direction we need to go.
Like the empty homes tax, right?
Yeah.
It brings in money, which is great, and it might get people, and it might not bring in money, which would be also great because it would mean that people would have changed their behavior to a manner that was better, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
In line with speaking of support, and you mentioned some fear-mongering, I think we saw some protests today in council as a number of residents of primarily, I guess, the west side of Vancouver are very up in arms about the school tax that's being brought in by the province. You know, they use language like, you know, blood from a stone, and this is discrimination, you're forcing people from their homes. Are you anticipating something similar around the land value capture? Do you think it's going to engage people in that same way?
It could. I mean, one of the things I like about a land value capture is that it's targeted, and so it's harder to argue against because we're saying, look, we can measure where wealth has been passive wealth has been accumulated, then we can collect it when you realize it. So you know, the optimist in me thinks that's hard to argue against, and we can all just hold hands and move on forward. Obviously, that's not the lived experience of my first six weeks in office.
It just feels like 6 months.
Yeah, whichever. 60 years. I suspect there'd be some opposition. You know, I think there are folks who feel like they have earned those dramatic windfall gains in their property value because they made the right decision to buy at that point. And we hear in the school tax debate, like, there are people who really, I think, who really feel like they are struggling under the impact of this tax. Now, I think the thing that's missing from these conversations is perspective of what that struggling looks like relative to folks across the spectrum who are struggling in the housing crisis in Vancouver. So it's tricky. You know, I've been listening to speakers, and I do get the feeling that their experiences that they're struggling, and probably relative to folks they know, they think that that's true. So I'm interested also in how we can build a bigger sense of perspective around the housing crisis in Vancouver. Again, this is the optimist in me, but use that as a way to build some empathy about what struggle looks like. One of the key benefits, I think, and privileges of home ownership is the choices that it provides that renters just don't have. So if you own a $5 million home and you really can't afford the tax, you know, you could buy a $2.5 million home and you're still luckier than almost everyone in Vancouver, and you're not paying the tax anymore. Now,
I guess having $2.5 million in the bank would be a pretty good outcome.
Yeah, I think that would, you know, and people don't want to move. They want to stay.
Your average rent eviction victim is probably not facing that same value benefit.
Yeah,
right?
Which is where the kind of perspective comes in, I think. You know, so people want to stay in this house they've been in and they don't feel like that's an option. But I mean, in reality, it is an option. Maybe it's not one you like, but it's still an option that you have over a lot of people who don't have that option. Now, you know, related to density and one city is every neighborhood for everyone plan, I think we should have more homes worth less than $3 million around our wealthier neighborhoods so that people could stay in their community and their neighborhood, but not have the burden, as it seems to be, of a more than $3 million home. So there's value, I think, in giving people more housing choices within their neighborhood so that downsizing might be an option. And then we can have more neighbors at different income levels in all those neighborhoods. And I think it would improve those neighborhoods. And it all fits together so nicely in my head.
Great.
Yeah.
So I guess just to round out a couple of broader questions is, you know, we saw a lot of interesting, you know, dynamic on council so far is a lot of cooperative motion. We saw, you know, Councillor Carr amended your motion with language that had been submitted by Councillor Dominato, two mm-hmm. people of different political parties. Are you finding this really enjoyable working with everybody? Are you finding it works well?
Yeah, there's a really good spirit right now of trying to work together, and where we can't work together, of being relatively pleasant and cooperative anyway. I'm sure that will get harder as we get into the details of things. But, you know, I'm glad that it exists right now. I hope it lasts as long as it can, because I think it makes government better to not be spending all our time bickering with one another. I have, in other interviews, used our mix at Vancouver's council as a plug for proportional representation, because I think we are doing our best to work together in what is functionally a kind of minority government situation with no ruling majority. And the hope is that it brings better outcomes for everybody. And so far, we're doing decently at that. So I will keep it up from my end, and we'll see. We'll see how far into these 4 years we get with it.
Right. And then lastly, I guess you've been putting a lot of work into this land value capture motion. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's one of the biggest things that you're working on. Now that it's passed, what else are you working on?
So I've been working on another motion around climate justice, which is a big, long-time passion and also deep-seated fear and anxiety in my life. So I've been working, getting feedback from some other councillors and the mayor, who I know are all interested in climate issues, and as well as working with climate justice allies, who I have worked with for years, to shape a motion hoping to ramp up the city's ambition around its own climate plan to meet the more urgent targets that the latest climate science report back in October put out for us. So that is, again, slightly nerdy, but ramping up climate ambition is, I think, really important. And then we're going to head into a city plan. And One City supporters had lots to say during the election, as did folks we were just talking to on doorsteps. We did a lot of door knocking and talked a lot about what the city could look like. And those conversations will be key in the city plan. So we'll keep working on how we make sure that voices of support for inclusive neighborhoods are heard during the city plan, and we can be moving in that direction.
Great. And is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'm glad for the coverage you guys are providing, and we will keep working hard. And I would encourage folks, I know a lot of people get involved in elections during campaigns, or get involved in politics during election campaigns, and there's a lot of work to be done in all of the rest of the time to be supporting the kinds of issues that you got excited about during the campaign. So if you want to keep being involved, I would encourage that. It really matters that we have a robust democracy all the time. And we would love to have folks come and join, get involved in One City between elections if they're interested too. You can find us all over the social medias.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Councillor Christine Boyle. And as I said earlier, there was quite the controversial motion, which was Councillor Rebecca Bly's motion on overturning the school tax, or I should say, writing a letter to the mayor asking that he overturn the school tax. But what occurred during Councillor Boyle's motion discussion was that a number of protesters entered the council chambers. We didn't really notice them at first until councillors took note of them and started looking up at the gallery. And finally, I sort of craned my neck and I could see a number of protesters holding a variety of signs. There are some photos that occurred, but, you know, signs that read, "No blood from stones," "We will not be discriminated against," things like that. And what these were homeowners, primarily, I assume, in the West End, which is where this tax is primarily going to impact, who own $3 million, $4 million, $5 million, $7 million homes, and for whom this tax is going to apply to them. And they'll be having to pay upwards of $1,500 to $2,000 a year in the tax. And some of them, it might be as high as $8,000 or $10,000 a year if they're owning a home of, say, $5 or $6 million. So they're quite upset about it. And it was interesting. They came into the room around the same time as Christine Boyle's motion was finishing. And the next motion on the bill, on the order paper, was a motion calling to build more modular housing. And it was an interesting disconnect, I think, between the protesters who were, you know, protesting a tax on their $6 million homes and a whole host of city councilors talking about the importance of housing the homeless. But I did get a chance to sit down with Mary Lavin, one of the organizers for the protest, and talk to her about the protest, and I'll put that on now. So I'm standing here with Mary, who's an organizer for the school tax opposition here at City Council. Can you just tell me a little bit about yourself and your organization?
Sure. I'm a teacher. I was born and raised in Vancouver. I lived here all my life, so I've seen a lot of changes taking place in the city. And I'm part of a group called Step Up, which is a group of residents. We're a grassroots organization of mostly long-term residents who are not very happy with the province's intention to put in what they're referring to as a school tax, but in fact it's a homeowner's tax. The money from the tax goes to general revenue, it doesn't go to schools. And since we already pay a school tax in our municipal taxes, we don't think that it's fair for the province now to be, well, somewhat deceptively calling it a school tax and asking us to pay an extra tax, which appears to us just to be a tax grab. And it's an unfair tax because it only targets a select group of individuals. That is people whose assessed value of their homes is over $3 million.
Right. And with that, so I saw in your release that it said 21,000 homes are going to be impacted. So 93% of homes in City of Vancouver will not be impacted. Isn't that the case?
That's correct.
Right. So I guess the question that could be asked by some is that, you know, how much sympathy should the City of Vancouver have for the top 6% of households?
So it's not an issue of sympathy. We're not looking for sympathy. It's an issue of fairness. If we have to pay a tax, and we have not seen any evidence from the province that this extra money is needed for anything in particular, but if we were provided with that evidence, and if in fact the money is needed, we have no problem paying a tax, but it needs to be a fair tax. And so Councillor Bly's motion, which is what we're here about today at City Hall, they're going to debate and make a decision regarding Councillor Bly's motion. She has recommended that the city write a letter to the province and suggest that the school tax is not a fair tax, it's a bad tax, and that it would be a better tax, if the money is needed, to have a progressive income tax, which would then be citywide, and so it would be a much more fair way of acquiring funds if the funds are needed, and it also would put much less of a burden on any individual homeowner, and it would not target just a select group of people. So it would be based on one's ability to pay. Right now with the proposed school tax, the assumption is that just because you live in a home that has escalated in value, which is through no fault or effort of the homeowner, that somehow you've got stashes of cash in your basement to pay, which of course we don't have. You know, the money is in our home and we don't see it unless we sell the property.
So that was Mary Lavin of the organization Step Up, which is not to be confused with the American film franchise about what I understand to be hip-hop dancing. It is more to be to deal with stepping up to oppose the school tax on houses over $2 million. Following the protest, or as the protest were on, Councillor Bly's motion did come to the table, and it was debated, and eventually it was passed. And I did get a chance to sit down with Councillor Bly after the motion passed and have a conversation with her about it, and I'll put that on now. And Councillor, thank you for sitting down with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
You moved a motion today that you had passed, which is a motion calling on the province to essentially scrap the school tax. One of the things that you talked about in your motion was that this encroaches in the tax base, that this is municipal tax land being taken over by the province. Do you want to sort of explore that a little bit about what that concern is from the city's perspective?
Sure. Well, as a city councillor, I can share from my perspective, and now that this has passed, 7 out of the 10 that are sitting. So I would actually start by defining encroachment in a simple Google search, which is, it's a gradual advance beyond usual or acceptable limits. So by definition, that's encroachment. So we have to understand that our ability to raise revenues, allocate funds in the city, is primarily through taxes, property taxes. So to have the province, and the province, of course, raises funds through income tax and sales tax and other ways. So to have the province sort of single out Vancouver as a way to raise even more money, we call that the surcharge on the school tax, we see is the encroachment on our municipal tax base, our only way to raise money. I can go on. The $118 million that will be raised through this surcharge, or would have been raised through the surcharge, is 29% of what we have already charged our residents in terms of property tax.
Right,
so it's a substantial spike. So that 29% actually takes away from what we could further charge down the road, knowing that we're already facing a property tax hike in our 2019 budget, operating budget.
So looking at, and you know, obviously the protesters are in the building today, and I got their leaflet, and I looked at some of their numbers, and I compared that with the statistics, and it seems like the tax is going to be applied to about 6% or 6.5% of all properties in Vancouver.
So. About just over 21,000.
But that's a fairly small percentage of the housing. And so do you think, is that truly a concern from an encroachment perspective, given the small percentage of houses that it actually involves? Or is this something that, like, if the province gets into the mood of taxing property, they're just going to expand?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things. And I would say that I articulated that in the closing arguments around, or in closing statements around, that this is somewhat of a philosophical motion in terms of the province in an overreaching, way of raising more funds. So that, but I think the number of homes that are actually affected by this is less. I just don't think it plays as much as the fact that the reason it's only that number of homes is because a certain part of our population has been targeted and perceived to have more liquidity, more cash, more wealth than other folks. And that's quite a divisive tactic, I would say, from the provincial government, and why I, as an Eastside renter, rented here for 20 years, I have two kids, I'm not going to buy in Vancouver anytime soon, has also taken a stand, because Yes, that's so, what I'll say to that.
So yeah, to switch gears and engage with that a bit, because you did say something really interesting in your closing remarks, which is you said that you're seeing on both ends of the spectrum. Some people are saying if you can't afford Vancouver move, that would be the typical sort of, you know, business type, you know, right of center concept, which is, you know, if you want to live here, pay for it. And then there's, you know, on the left-hand side of that spectrum, you have people saying, well, hey, if you can't afford the tax, maybe you shouldn't live in an expensive home. And you sort of drew this parallel between them as though they were similar. And I thought that was really interesting. Do you want to talk about
that? Sure. I mean, I'd like to say a couple of comments to that. The first is that I would argue that it's a typical right of center frame of mind. I'd be cautious not to make that blanket statement. We heard from a number of speakers the other night, and there was one person who I think Councillor Fry pointed out in Decide and Debate today that he did hear that, and that was unsettling, and I would agree.
Yeah, it's certainly a stereotype. Yeah, it's aren't the norm necessarily.
Exactly. Right? So what I would say is that there's also a smaller number of people that are saying, well, if you don't like paying more taxes, maybe you shouldn't live in such an expensive house and move. And the point of that, back to the divisive, and actually to Mayor Stewart's point around what campaign promises we're delivering on, I campaigned, it was on my campaign website, that I'm campaigning to bring more harmony to a very divisive, what feels to be coming more of a divisive tone in amongst the citizens of Vancouver, and that there is this massive middle group that is not in a fight. They actually just want to live in Vancouver and feel like people are their neighbor. That's why we love Vancouver. And this sort of far left and far right, and anything that comes into the conversation like this surcharge is causing more divisiveness. So to bring it back, that's how I brought those two thoughts together, is that either way, they're on either ends of the spectrum, and therefore anything that triggers that kind of conversation to bubble up in more than normal tax policy or even any municipal policy is a problem. So as you've probably noticed, we work really hard as a council now with no majority to work together to make amendments, to find consensus, and I'm proud to be part of that council, yeah. So it's not that dissimilar to what, it's just on a larger scale. So we can't just isolate this $2,000 and say that's not a lot of money. Because as I pointed out, you know, one of the people, he was in his 80s and he's paying $8,400 just in school tax. So it brings his overall bill $15,200 plus $8,400 in school tax.
Right,
for a pensioner,
like an $8 million valued
home. A $5 million home, but the actual structure is valued at $78,000.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't have a car. They live pretty frugally. So this is what we're really talking about. And the one thing I would say is that we have the empty homes tax, we have speculation tax, we have property transfer tax. The provincial government cast a net. It's not even clear what problem they were solving, but they cast a net that has caught too many people in Vancouver and not really the ones that they, I think, would claim to be trying to solve some sort of unfair, or whether it's foreign ownership or whatever the thing is that they're trying to position this as, unfortunately that net's caught too many of the wrong people.
Right, sort of the 21,000 households that are affected by the tax, you know, some of them, for whatever reason, they can't defer it or what have you, basically. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, the deferral is a whole other conversation, but at the end of the day, it's impacting too many people that are homegrown Vancouverites that have lived in their homes or even multiple homes in Vancouver over the last 30 or 40 years.
You did have your motion amended, just as I think every motion has had itself amended sometimes 7 or 8 times.
Yes.
How are you finding this spirit of cooperation?
Oh, I think it's hopeful. I think it should have Vancouver residents feeling like people are in this for the right reasons. And you may notice that we're not sort of voting in blocks in terms of the way that our you know, we're connected through our political platforms or parties. Pete and I had a conversation about this motion, and we debated and discussed as well, just as we would hope people do that are making decisions. And I had no reservations really about his amendment. I actually thought it was quite well thought out, and it created more clarity around the resolution.
And I was going to ask you about that, actually, is, you know, you had the Greens support you on this motion, and I think for some that was a surprise, maybe not for others. Did you know that they were going to support you?
No, actually. I know, of course, Adrian has spoken out mm-hmm. against the school tax, so I knew that. Even those within, you know, their caucus and ours, there's been a lot of discussion around how it should be framed and what do we really want to do with it. So I was surprised that we had all three Greens vote in favor, and happily I must add that they saw it. And I believe that they listened to the speakers and they deliberated with their own thought process around it and came to that decision mindfully on their own will. Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is one of the first times that you've been really at the center of a lot of people coming forward and speaking at council. And I've always wondered, what does it feel like being a councillor and having, you know, up to 50 people, or however many it was, speak on an issue that you've moved forward?
Well, look, I won't sit here and say, hey, I've sort of, you know, taken this and led with it, so to speak, in that many people with support and discussion, you know, really helped bring this motion to life. Certainly as a new city councillor, I was working many hours behind the scenes to even understand and really get up to speed on how this all works and what this tax really looks like. So it's been an incredible learning opportunity for me. But to have 50 people come, or it was 33 sign up to speak, and then to have everybody come today, it really just underscored how important it is for us to bring thoughtful policy forward, and that people in Vancouver, they will show up and they will demonstrate their support and they'll rally together.
Great. Well, I just have one last question.
Sure.
That's, you've got this motion behind you now, and you've got, you know, 4 more years of being on council. If you were to say one issue that you wanted to be your primary issue for the next 4 years, what do you think it would be?
Well, I think that what I would like to, that's a big...
Or just an area of focus, whether it's...
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say, you know, we can say it's the affordability, but it's how we do it. I don't have all the answers, of course, and but I do believe quite strongly that it's a series of smaller pivots and decisions and motions that will be brought forward that will contribute to making the city more affordable. I do hold a picture in my mind that will happen with the right time and attention to it. So it's bringing back this affordability. I'm part of that middle. It's tight from month to month. It can be, you know, and so I'm not going to be ashamed of that. That's just because I love living in the city and I'm committed and I have kids that have grown up here. So to create more opportunities, more housing that works for more people, and getting into some brave conversations with people to disrupt the status quo in order to figure out what do we need to get there. And I'll be completely honest, it's with everybody. It's with really small developers that are building 6-story, you know, rentals in East Van that aren't making billions of dollars. It's to look at how do we tax in development. And I voted in support of the land value capture discovery motion today because I do think that we can rewrite some of the way that it's been done in order for it to work better for Vancouverites.
That's really interesting. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
All right, so that was Councillor Rebecca Bly talking about her motion to overturn the school tax. What we did see throughout that whole process was, I think everybody had sort of understood that Councillor Carr was likely to vote with Councillor Bly and the rest of the NPA team on the motion. The thought being at the time that, you know, Councillor Carr had been speaking against it for some time, and that would result in probably a narrow majority for the vote. What ended up happening, however, was at the end of it, all three Green councillors voted in favor of it, as I mentioned in my interview with Councillor Bly, and that caused a bit of a storm of online protests, I guess. Matthew would probably call it a tempest in a teapot. But we did see quite a bit of social media commentary, and I think the Greens were feeling a bit of heat afterwards. And so I did reach out to Councillor Fry, and I sat down with him this evening to talk about where the motion went, why they ended up supporting it, and what the details of it were. And I'll put that interview on now. All right, so I'm sitting down with Councillor Fry of the Green Party, and you had a bit of a contentious day yesterday in council. You know, I think the big question on everybody's minds is this vote that occurred on the school tax. And the Green Party sided with the NPA and voted to call for the province to eliminate the school's tax, essentially. Is that a fair assessment?
You know, I look at it less as sided with the NPA and more like a judo move. We kind of redirected the NPA's motion. So you were there that day, and the motion as it was passed was heavily amended. I offered pretty significant amendment to it that did get almost unanimous support from all of council, even those who didn't vote for the final motion. So we changed the narrative a little bit around that motion to really focus it less on the tax fairness issue and more on the notion that it's an incursion into our limited tax base as a municipality. We only have our property tax and licensing and fees and stuff with which we can draw upon. The province has numerous revenue sources, including, you know, property transfer tax, speculation tax, sales tax, liquor tax, marijuana tax, royalties. The province has several ways to extract cash. We are limited in our revenue sources, and I think fundamentally where a lot of the impacts of the brunt of these wildly escalating housing values are felt directly here in our housing market. So when we look at these land values, and if the province is using that as kind of a blank check to draw upon, we need to sort of at least make them acknowledge that this is coming at our expense. And I think that, you know, largely in what I was trying to articulate through the conversations that didn't get captured in the media reporting, but as you were there and you saw, you know, in the subsequent conversation and in the amendment, I addressed the people in the audience who were there from the Step Up group, that this wasn't to support them. It was more on the notion of we need to protect our limited tax base. And we, you know, probably know where we need to spend the money as a city.
So I want to get to your views on sort of taxing affluence for in a minute. But first of all, when it comes to this tax encroachment, what you talk about is, I guess, if you were to say there's, say, 10 different kinds of taxation and the province has 8 of them and the city has 2 of them, if the province...
We have one of them.
One of them.
Licensing and fees, it's not really taxation.
But. Fair. So 9 and then 1. So you get that 1 and the province starts to do a small incursion in that. So in this case, 6% of households in Vancouver are going to be impacted by this tax. Do you think that is actually an incursion?
Well, you know, we've had estimates it's about $150 to $200 million in 2019. So it's not a small...
So small number of houses, but it's a lot of money.
It's just a significant amount of money. And I think it goes to say that as a city, we would love the opportunity to have maybe different property classes. Maybe we had a different property class for mansions and a different property class for, you know, affordable rental homes or whatever, right? We could have a myriad of different tools like that. The province denies us those tools because, of course, the province sets those rules. But the province themselves are able to capitalize on that opportunity. And that does speak to a fundamental fairness issue. And especially when you look at, when you talk about homes valued over $3 million, there's only a few markets in the province that really that touches upon. I mean, Whistler, maybe the Okanagan, maybe parts of the island, and Vancouver, and West Vancouver.
Actually, a lot of places where I guess there's green MLAs or MPs or city council.
Oh, touche. Well,
Oak
Bay would probably be one of them, yeah. But you know, the Okanagan and stuff, and there's no greens in the Okanagan. We know that.
Well, yet.
Yeah. You know.
I mean, there's a provincial election eventually.
Yeah, it might be a while before we get greens in the Okanagan, but that's another story. But what I do think that that we can look at is that Vancouver, amongst all those other affluent municipalities, we have some really profound problems that are directly related to our housing affordability and stuff that we are continuously getting offloaded by senior governments. So we, you know, we're front lines for the opioid crisis, and we, as a municipality, we're putting forward a lot of our civic cash towards fighting the opioid crisis. Similarly with homelessness, and you know, we're building more housing than any other municipality in the province. I mean, we're stepping up and pulling our weight.
The phrase is often used, downgrading, that the province is downgrading
exactly.
Functions that they would traditionally do to the city, and it's stretching the city's budget. And you saw that with
and you know, we're hammering. You can see the budget right there. It's a thick book, and there's a lot of stuff we got to go through, and it's painful to look at what we have to pony up for and what's being downloaded onto the city. So I think it's important to send that signal. And I think it's also noteworthy that this is pretty symbolic. It's a signal. We're just asking the mayor to write a letter. And, you know, as the mayor, you know, is given a set of instructions from the municipality and from council saying, you know what, we see that you're incurring, there's an incursion into our tax base and we have a problem with it. And maybe that's a tool that the mayor can then use for leverage when it comes time to talking about some of the other stuff that we passed that very same day. So, you know, one of the other motions we passed was asking the province for 600 more units of modular housing. Maybe the mayor can go in with those two motions hand in hand and say, hey, look, I know you won't give me the tax base. Why don't you give me the 600 units of modular housing or whatever, right? It's a leverage tool.
Speaking to that specifically is I've seen a lot of blowback on social media about this sort of, I guess Justin McElroy coined the term Green PA Alliance with the Greens and the NPA signing together. So speaking to that is on the, a lot of the blowback is this idea that, you know, a lot of people support the idea of taxing the wealthy and the landed wealthy, in particular, given how many people have precarious housing. And you were pretty clear in your statement about where you stood on that. Do you want to elaborate on where you stand on the idea of the principle of the school tax, not necessarily who's in, who's running it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of a messy tool in its implication, and I've been on record supporting Housing Affordability BC's recommendations back again. I think this goes back to 2014. This was Tom Davidoff and a bunch of economists talking about sort of front-loading property taxes and then allowing them to be declared against, offset against income taxes and that kind of a thing, which would be a tool to capture a lot of the wealthy speculators or the non-local tax-paying speculators. I mean, I think there's a myriad of tools to address, and I think one of the things that gets sort of conflated and confused with this conversation is about land use. So there's taxing wealth, and then there's also using this tax, because I think a lot of people see this tax in particular as a means to affect land use change. And I'm not sure that it necessarily is the right tool to do that. I can appreciate where people think that it might be, but I don't think that it necessarily will achieve that. In fact, it may actually have the opposite effect in many respects because, you know, I mean, I was pretty critical of some of the folks who had come and spoken and talked about their hypocrisy and how they'd presented. And I think you were there for some of that in the council. But I mean, there were some legitimate hard luck cases of people who, you know, retired, couldn't defer their taxes because they had a mortgage or whatever, you know. So I get that it lacked a bit of nuance.
Well, that actually leads into where I was going to go next, which, you know, there's a line in Hamilton, which is, you know, winning is easy, governing is harder. Are you finding that this is a good example or that you're finding that governing...
Dude, winning is not easy. I ran three times before I won.
I guess you're the last person I should say that to on city council.
Yeah.
But, you know, realistically, governing is, it sounds like it's pretty hard.
Yeah, it is certainly, you know, I mean, I think, you know, I specific to this motion, I think there's another element that to capture here. And that's that as Green, we're not necessarily as beholden to the provincial government as other, I mean, Gene answers to no one, but other people on council or the mayor's office have, you know, affiliations with the provincial government that they need to maintain and nurture. And it's more challenging for them to speak out. And it's kind of a political backstory, but I think it's, you know, when you start looking at who's in whose party and that kind of thing, there is some alliances there that
that again leads well into the where I was going with this, which is when you look at some councillors, you can say, well, they're pretty aligned with this provincial party that's been around since the 1930s, depending on what name change they went with. And there's been this other group of councillors that have been around since, you know, they're with the provincial party more or less since the 1940s. And, you know, we have an idea of where they stand on things.
Yeah.
The Greens, you know, Elizabeth May is now, I think, 9 years into being an MP, but, you know, one MP doesn't necessarily have a huge voting record make. Andrew Weaver was 4 years, but not in a minority parliament, so it didn't really matter. And Adrian Carr, same thing. That's
exactly it. So there was a very comfortable position for Councillor Carr to be in the last term because we knew that the Vision majority was going to do what they were going to do, and anything else anybody else did really could be symbolic or for show or for on principle or whatever. And the difficult, as you alluded to, the difficulty of governing wasn't a factor because Vision had that all under control. So we're in, you know, different territories. And certainly as we try and hammer out this budget decision, and I mean, there's many different ways this budget can go, right? I mean, we don't legally have to pass the budget till the spring. Now, I hope that we do not get ourselves in that position, but that's the right legal context that we could stretch this out. And there are people on council who would love to do that. Not people that I'm of a party affiliation with, but there are people who are certainly looking at that.
So to pull back again to this sort of what the Green Party is, would you say that everybody that voted for the Green Party knew what the Green Party stood for?
Gosh, I have no idea. I mean, I don't think... I think it's hard to say who voted for us. And
right. But I mean, every party has people that vote for them, not necessarily in their own best interest or not necessarily because they're fully informed.
It's, it's funny. This is a bit of a tangent, but I've had a hard time like sort of extracting some of the social media chatter from the reality of voter intention. I mean, there's a lot of people who command a lot of interaction and attention and like demand more as a member of the electorate, who I'm pretty sure never would have voted for me in the first place, but they act as if I have an obligation to them as a voter, mm-hmm. when I know that there's not really. So, I mean, there's almost, one could suggest that there's almost an adversarial side to that. So it's hard to say who voted. You know, like, what's interesting is that a lot of people who contacted me in the last 24 hours to articulate how they felt about how I voted, and when I explained why I voted, and I posted on my Facebook page sort of a broader explanation, because of course a lot of people weren't there, and the minutes haven't been posted, and the video hasn't been posted, so they're kind of just going on.
And they'll infrequently go and look at that anyways.
Yeah, sure, and they're going on what they saw, and Brandon Yan tweeted something, or Justin McElroy's story, or they'll get a partial picture, and they won't really even know, most people didn't know that the motion was amended in the first place. And in fact, I was, I wasn't going to vote for the motion until my amendment went through. Like, I had no intention to vote for that original motion as it was framed, because I thought it was clunky and pandered to the notion of protecting the wealthy land ownership. And as I articulated in my closing statements on that amendment, that's a conversation that we have to have. And I'm not suggesting in any way that we're not going to have that conversation. My fundamental issue with it, and I knew that the could get the MPA on side and could actually get this letter to pass, as I articulated earlier, there would have been some resistance due to political alliances from other members of the left. Some people have suggested, why didn't you just approach this from the left? But I don't think that would have been possible. And I think this was an opportunity to send a signal that, again, this issue of tax encroachment is so critical. As we as a city get so much services and expectations downloaded onto us, we need to assert more and new tools that we can get more value out of the difficult land conversations. We've got a finite amount of land, and we need to have a little bit more control over how we use and tax and zone and all that kind of stuff.
So all three Green Party councillors voted for the motion. And one of the things that I've always heard from the Green Party is that they're a party of free votes, that everybody makes their own decisions, and you can't expect the Green Parties to always walk in lockstep. My question here is, was there a conversation between the three of you about how you were going to vote, or, did you all just come to it naturally?
Well, Councillor Carr was pretty clear that she was going to support the motion. She'd made a commitment to that on the campaign trail. She talked about it during the campaign, so she was going to support it as it was. So the way I looked at it, and my mic really wasn't that into supporting it at all, and neither was I, and then came up with the amendment that I thought actually managed to make it work, got the MPA on side with a very different motion, I feel, and then it was something that we could run with. So I saw it as an opportunity to push a slightly different narrative. Like I say, it's like a judo move, the way I saw it, just taking that momentum and rechanneling it into a slightly different direction to achieve a different objective.
Right. And so what are the challenges that you think there are now in communicating why the Green Party does what it does, right? You're going to have a lot of people that had whatever point of view they had about the Green Party, and now that you're making votes and decisions, what are the challenges in telling them how you're voting?
Yeah, well, for people who pay attention to this sort of thing, some folks might have noticed that I kind of checked out of social media since getting elected. And to be totally honest,
I've heard that's a really good idea.
It's been great. It's been great. I really recommend it, actually. But I realize, actually, after the last 24 hours, that I have a responsibility to be a bit. I mean, when I posted my version of why I voted as I voted, I think a lot of people really appreciated it and told me that they appreciated it and appreciated the transparency. So whereas I checked out of social media because I was getting sick of the sort of Twitter bubble and the snide commentary, and there's just too much going on. And frankly, I'm just way too busy and I need to rest my brain every once in a while. So I was happy to check out of it, but I see now that I need to strike a balance. So that'll be my earnest intent. Although I am like ridiculously busy. I am so much more sympathetic to the people who came before me, and I've always been try to be relatively charitable to the other political adversaries over the years as just a community activist and stuff. But man, it's a lot of work. There's a lot of expectation. There's a lot of letters that people send you. Some of them
and a few that are being written right now.
A few that are being written right now. Some of them are like form letters. Some of them are earnest. Yeah. Getting through that rent evictions motion was a major challenge because there was a lot of backroom kind of negotiation and horse trading and trying to make sure that we could like make it happen. Because that was an achievement in and of itself, right? I mean, that's another case of like, did we vote with the MPA or did we bring the MPA along? And I think that was a far more powerful motion as it was passed because we brought the NPA along. And we showed that as a unified council, left, right, whatever you want to call it, west side, east side, north, south, we all had some very core values that were ready to stand behind renters in our city. And I think that there's a lot of value in that. And again, a lot of the terms of that motion were like, write a letter to the province and ask them pretty please to do this, that, and the other thing. And I think there's a lot of value in achieving that consensus. I know a lot of people think, oh, it's a sellout to get consensus, blah, 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 blah. You know, we'll have those hard fight pushes that don't get consensus. Those are yet to come. But I think on stuff like this, where it's a real values-based decision, I think it's important to get consensus.
Great. And I guess I just have one final question is, what's your biggest surprise? I haven't had a chance to connect with you since you became a counselor. And what's your biggest surprise so far now that you're 6 or so weeks in?
You know, as a community advocate kind of guy, I often had had to push back on staff a lot, and I was challenging staff a lot from the community perspective. Now I find myself in a role where I'm protecting staff more, which has been, you know, and not because I have to, but because I want to, and because I see the work that they do, and I see that there's opportunities here, that we've entered a whole new kind of political sphere, which is a little less politicized than it has been in the past. And there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of staff are really excited about the opportunity for change, the way we're doing things differently. I think people are really surprised about the way the entire council gets along, even though we're different parties and we have different views. Everybody actually genuinely gets along. I mean, it's only been a month and a bit, but
give it time.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first 3 years should be okay. I mean, by the fourth year, we'll probably be in election mode. But I do think that there's a different tone, and it's in part because there's no absolute majority, so we have to work together, and that's cool.
Seems like it'll be interesting times, and doubly interesting times to be a podcaster covering it.
Nice.
So, well, thank you very much for your time. Again, Councillor Fry.
Mr. Meehan, always a pleasure.
So it was really interesting to sit down with Councillor Fry and talk about that. Obviously, you know, this is a new council and they're all finding their legs, and it clearly was quite a difficult decision for them. I do really note that this is the importance that for Councillor Fry appears to really be the idea that it's encroaching on the tax base of the city, and a concern that there's a need to maintain that ability. At the same time, you know, I think a lot of people find it pretty difficult to really truly feel bad, I guess, for people that sit in $3, $4, or $5 million homes and need to pay a few thousand dollars a year towards it. I think it's such an interesting issue because this is really a non-major motion. It's a motion really just to write a letter. And so it was interesting to see the Greens come out in favor of this. I kind of leaned into it with Councillor Fry a little bit. I tried to ask about, you know, they're not always going to vote with different people. They're not always going to vote with each other. And this is something that we know about the Greens. They're a brand new party. They're not a brand new party. They've been around for decades, but this is the first real chance in Canada of them having a real governing say. Councillor Fry himself even said that, you know, they are the voters caught in the middle in a lot of ways. And so it's going to be interesting over the next 4 years to see how they carve that out and how they become a real party that sort of is able to actually have an identity and have a sense of self and isn't just, you know, a party that votes always with the NPA or a party that always votes with, say, Christine Boyle or anybody else. And so it is going to be quite curious to see. So this has been a particularly special version of the Cambie Report, where we managed to get an interview with a couple of councillors that we hadn't sat down with before, and we're very excited to keep doing this and keep taking a look at what goes on throughout the course of the term. On behalf of the Cambie Report, please visit us on patreon.com/CambieReport, and I suppose I should probably say that a couple more times, patreon.com/CambieReport, and I guess just for Matthew, patreon.com/CambieReport. But yeah, please like and subscribe and comment and let us know what you thought about this special episode. On behalf of the Cambie Report, my name is Patrick Meehan, signing off.